Blog Talk Radio.
Hoping to get you back up and fully away. When your life is at stake, I'm just doing what it takes. Do you have the heart to be an EMT? Do you have the bravery to be a firefighter? When things get hectic, when they get tragic, do you have the courage to be a paramedic? Made of the few, only rare select. Stand up, show yourself, command respect. Show them what you got.
And after we kind of came in after a popcorn sale, blew the dust off this thing and said, what the hell, this is One Union 801, the webcast. Yes, I know, we're on an off night. Going to catch everybody off guard. I am John Broyles, SSGJ Broyles on Twitter, John.Broyles1 on Facebook. I figure, what the hell, we'll just go ahead and flip the big switch tonight. 888-488-5536 is the number to call in. We're going to have something special as soon as I open up our mic. And while I wait for the interwebs to catch up.
888-488-5536
is the number to call in. Turn
it down. How did you mute that? I did. I just did. I didn't realize it was going to start playing on me. Oh, my God. What is this?
That voice coming about, 1,500 miles to my east. About the same amount if you're looking at the same map. Medic Tramish here is on with us tonight. She's going to be talking with us about PCP and head injuries, which Angel Dust, head injuries. Yeah, okay, I can see the correlation there. Let's see, a few quick notes here. Our normally silent co-host and call screener, D.L. Moore, she is resting comfortably. Or resting in a position of comfort in the bed as she is fighting yet another infection. Cancer kind of does that to you at times. And I do know that there are a couple small things that are going to be going up on the show's website, oneunion801thewebcast.com. Yes, it still exists, just like the show. I do know there's going to be a special link put up there right after the show, so you might want to pay attention to what it is. Okay, like I said earlier, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to be right here holding her hand, but I'm going to give it over to her.
Oh, come on. This was supposed to be a banter. This was supposed to be back and forth. But, hey, y'all, it's Shal Tramish here. You guys can call me Shal. It's, you know, got this nickname from, oh, good Lord, about 10, 15 years ago. So for those of you who are listening who don't know me, I'm a paramedic who lives somewhere in the east. I blog incognito. My blog name is, and drum roll please, because it is the longest blog name in EMS blog history. It is www.lookingthroughapairofpinkhandledtraumashears.com. I know. Awesome. I think that's the longest, just regular name and longest blog name, period. You can find me on my blog at lookingthroughapairofpinkhandledtraumashears.com. You can also find me on Facebook at Paramedic Shaolin Traumashear. And you can also find me on Twitter at Medic Traumashear. Just drop the E off. So John has been so absolutely gracious. Thank you very much, darling, to allow me to come on to the podcast to do what I thought was actually my first one, but no, I had actually called in and done one, about a good 5 years ago when I started blogging, but I really wanted to branch out. For those of you who don't know, yeah, I blog, I know, kind of not regularly, but over the last month, I've been dealing with an eye problem, so I am practically blind in one eye, so it's really hard for me to type, but John was so gracious and allowed me to kind of get some stuff out on the podcast. So much easier that way. So let's begin. PCP and head injuries. These are two things that are near and dear to my heart. I am a trauma junkie, as it is. I mean, come on now, look at the blog name. So I really like working with head injuries. I know. I really like working with head injuries, and I do like dealing with patients who are presenting abnormally, and PCP is one of those ones that we as EMS providers, well, I'll get to the head injuries in a second. PCP is one of those ones that we as EMS providers, we don't get to see very often because the prevalence of usage has gone down. it actually, come to find out during my research, I didn't even know this to begin with. During my research, I discovered that it was actually a drug used in the 1950s in hospitals, like ketamine. It was basically the 1950s version of ketamine, but they discovered that it had such dissociative and hallucinogenic effects that they stopped using it because people were basically going schizophrenic in their hospitals. And so that's when ketamine became used more often. So one of the big things they talk about with PCP, and what we all know and love about PCP, is one big red flag you see when you get called out for an unknown medical problem is someone running up and down the street naked. What makes you naked on PCP? Don't know. Actually, when I was doing my research, there's really not a lot PCP, because it's one of those things where people use it once and they have such a bad trip off of it, they're like, never again. So just to kind of give a little history of the medication, obviously PCP, which is short for phencyclidine, it's also known as angel dust, and it is still used in some places medically, and it's also known as Sernal. It has different names. It is a dissociative drug, so it is in the ketamine-like family. And as I said, it was brought to market. It was used in the 1950s, but was basically said goodbye by the FDA in about 1965 because it caused so many issues. So ketamine started its debut on the streets, as it were, in the late 60s, early 70s. Then it was considered to be the big bad, big bad wolf drug, because it just, when it hit and it hit hard. But even still, with all the other drugs out there, heroin, cocaine, crack, meth, X, whatever you want to use, it's always really still had this very low usage because of, you don't, with something like heroin, you can kind of get that midway. You feel really good, you feel really relaxed, or you can go all the way to someone shoving making you eat plastic. So there is kind of, everyone kind of gets a different usage. But with PCP, unfortunately, you only get one of two things. You get this euphoric, dissociative high, or you're running down the street naked. There is no in-between. And so that's kind of the, this is just medic trauma you're talking. This isn't, research talking. But I do think that's why there really isn't much research on PCP, because users, you don't want to do it again. A lot of the other ones you want to do again, at least one. PCP, not so much. And I actually talked on Facebook about saying that, about how I completely understood why someone wants to use heroin, why someone wants to use cocaine, why someone wants to use crack. I get that. I understand it. I can apply it, some physical thought to it. But I can't, I am perfectly content and able to run down my local highway naked, sober. Okay, maybe with a little bit of Merlot. But generally, I can do it. I mean, that's the thing. Generally, I can do it sober. But, give me a little bit of Merlot. What? Oh, well.
I want video.
Okay. Well, there is a really embarrassing story that, a couple of people know, where I was actually naked on a highway. But anyway, so. So, yeah, I understand that, but I don't understand a drug that's going to make you rip off all your clothes and run down the street, and when someone tries to stop you, you're going to beat them about the head and shoulders until they pretty much either medicate you with a whole crap ton of go the hell to sleep, or they shoot you and kill you. That's just not, that's just not the drug for me. Sorry. So, getting kind of back on subject, So some of the ways that you can use PCP, some of the ways that PCP is used is it's in a powder-like form. It kind of looks like, it kind of does look like cocaine. So you can, excuse me, you can smoke it, basically. The other thing that is usually the most prevalent, there was actually one of my favorite shows is Drug Inc., and I was watching that last night in preparation for this. They do something that's called dippers, where they'll take cigarettes and they'll dip them into a bottle of liquid PCP. And I thought this was actually kind of funny, where one of the dealers talked about how good he was because he would only dip the cigarette so much so that his clients could handle it. Because as he said, a dead client won't come back and buy more. So you can take your cigarette or you can take your joint and you can dip it in the marijuana, and it's called wet. I mean, it's, dip it in the PCP, and it's called wet, because even though I'm a former smoker, I know there's a bunch of former and still current smokers out there, and you know how when your cigarettes get wet, you can't use them. But with this stuff, because all the crap in it, it can be completely soaking wet, and you can still light the shit. I'm sorry. That means no to me. Anything you can set on fire and it's wet, no thank you. So that's how it can be used, and that's the most prevalent use is through a dipper, where they dip a cigarette or joint, a blunt, whatever, something to smoke, and they dip it in the liquid, and then they smoke it. So that's, you know, that's kind of how it's used. Depending on how much PCP you get in your system at one time, you can experience different things. You can experience very, very low doses. You get kind of like the euphoric intoxication, kind of, you know, almost like the nitrous oxide. You know, you're unsteady, kind of slurred a little bit. You know, basically you look like you're having a good time. And then, you know, all the way up to, you know, having full-on convulsions or, as I said, running down the middle of the highway naked. So some of the other effects are you get the hallucinations, suicidal impulses, all this. It basically just makes your brain go nuts. And there have been a lot of very high-profile cases of people who have been on PCP. I was actually kind of on the receiving end of two of them. Here, as a medic, we arrived on scene. We got dispatched for an unknown medical problem. We arrived on scene, and the patient was unresponsive. And when we kind of got him to come around, all of a sudden he starts fighting us. And there's about 10 of us on top of him, and he's still fighting. And he did that all the way to the hospital, where they had to knock them down and tube them, and they used about, a whole bunch of go the fuck to sleep. Oops, sorry, didn't mean to swear. they used a whole bunch of sleep meds to get them to finally calm down. But and then the second one was we got dispatched to a pedestrian struck by a vehicle, and we get on scene. There's a guy laying on the ground, naked, and my first thought was, oh, PCP. Watch this one. And within a few minutes, he was awake, and he had actually had a compound fracture to his right arm. And he's trying to punch me with his right arm that's flopping around everywhere because the bone ends are sticking out, and he's not even fazed by, I mean, he had pelvic injury, rib injury, you know, chest injury, flail segment, compound fracture of the arm, and he's going, he's still, you know, screaming that he's going to take me to Valhalla, which I'll give him credit because he used Valhalla. But yeah, so you have that, you know, that's what PCP does. And unfortunately, a good friend of mine who is a police officer was responding to a burglary incident, and the person who was robbing this house was high on PCP. And unfortunately, the suspect came after him, and he had to discharge his weapon. And he had to empty his magazine because the guy wasn't stopping. And the guy actually had wrestled the gun away from him, and he managed to get it back and, you know, do what he needed to do. But sadly, you know, that's what PCP does. And so we don't see it very often. So we're thinking, we as EMS providers, or, you know, let's just go broad spectrum and let's just say we as first responders, because the prevalence of PCP is so low, I fear that we'll walk in, my brothers and sisters will walk into a situation where they're thinking just, psych patient, and in all reality, it could be a patient who's hopped up on this drug that can cause them to be this crazy, deadly person. But anywho, back onto something a little bit more, a little bit more interesting. excuse me, management. Always good to know. We need to know how to fix this problem. So if we get someone that we see that is, hopped up on PCP, and we know that they're hopped up on PCP, what we can do, basically it's just supportive care. And when I mean supportive care, it's protect ourselves first. Remember, your partner, then the patient. So protect yourself. If you can't safely manage the patient, then don't manage the patient. I really shouldn't be saying that, but it is about your own personal safety. You have to think about that first and foremost. So for someone who is hopped up on PCP, things that you really need to watch out for, you need to watch the ABCs course. And the reason why they're running around naked is because their body temperature has gone up. So you really need to watch out for hyperthermia, and even, if they're running around in the middle of January and you're somewhere cold, you want to still watch out for hypothermia as well. So you can use benzos like lorazepam. That'll hopefully help control the agitation and seizures, and haloperidol to control the psychotic symptoms. But in all reality, this is pretty much a patient you just want to hog tie and get to somewhere where they get someone to them that can do RSI and take care of them appropriately. But let's see, what else do you want to know about PCP?
Let's see here. I haven't seen PCP since, oh God, and now I'm going to start dating myself here. Because I haven't heard of its prevalence since, like you said earlier, the 80s. In my case, the early 80s is the last time I saw or heard anything on TV about it, even.
Right.
Oh, is it starting to make its bounce back in some areas? Because even around here, I have not heard squat about somebody hitting the angel dust.
You know what? As I said, doing my research, there's very little to say. All it says is this is a very rare drug, which is quite obvious because it was one of those things that was on the market, used maybe 10, 15 years, and then it came off. And even when in the late 60s, when it saw its surge, in the late, we were talking 67, 68, what popped up in the '70s, '71, it was cocaine, it was crack. So I don't really think that it's been a big drug to begin with. But no, I mean, I've been doing this job for about 13 years now, and I personally have only dealt with two patients who were actually on PCP. And then I knew about the third one because we were there for the aftermath. But I really don't. In talking with my group of medics, I know that really in my little circle, we've only ever dealt with it. Each person only dealt with it maybe once or twice. So I don't think it's making a comeback. I think that what's happening is the other little designer drugs that are out there, Spice, K2, Flaca, which is kind of like a meth kind of thing, that Spice that was causing the PCP-like symptoms, and everyone was going, oh my God, PCP is back, and then they're like, oh no, it's not. So I don't really think it's making a comeback. I just think that it's now out there. And more people are looking at it, more people are seeing it and going, oh, okay, maybe, they're misidentifying one thing and looking at it, you know, and calling it this. But one thing that you can use, and I hope hopefully this is the one thing I can teach everyone, there is a PCP mnemonic that is out there. So symptoms of PCP can be described by the mnemonic device Red Danes, R-E-D-D-A-N-E-S. So Romeo Echo Delta, Delta Alpha November Echo Sierra. The breakdown is rage. Oh yes, I pulled out the military phonetics, didn't I?
Ooh, big phonetics there.
I did. So you know, Red Danes breaks down into rage, arrhythmia, which is redness of the skin, dilated pupils, delusions, amnesia, nystagmus, which is whenever you look at the eyes and you move your finger back and forth in front of the patient's eyes, they dart or wiggle back and forth. It looks really funny when you see it. Excitation and skin dryness. So I'm going to ask you, John, of that, what would you say that is? If someone presented with you with that symptoms, what would be your first thought?
And since I misspelled a lot while I was typing it out, honestly, the first thing that comes to my mind is organophosphate.
Exactly. And so that, I think, you know, that was my first thing when I was reading it. I was like, oh my God, that's organophosphate poisoning. If I knew nothing else about the patient, I would go, so were you sniffing bug killer or what? So, you know, there is that, but I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. There is a mnemonic that you can use to kind of narrow it down. You know, you want to start checking off the boxes of what could be wrong with my patient. Why is my patient trying to beat me to a bloody pulp? Kind of have that little bit of a, hey, I can kind of look at this and say, So yeah, there you go. So that's about PCP. Some famous PCP cases. They had actually said, if we remember back about a year or two ago, the Miami man who ate the face off of the homeless man under the bridge while he was naked. They said that he'd only had marijuana in his system, but I was actually trying to pull it up while I was kind of doing this little bit of an intro. They do say PCP almost acts like acid in the way where you can have a flashback. So it can stay in your system and that, yeah, it can stay in your system. And I'm trying to dig it up where I read it so that I can make sure to put it out there and so no one thinks I'm just kind of blowing smoke. But you can be into your system for up to 10 years. So,
really?
Well, yeah. So while the Miami man, while he only had marijuana in his system, he was 31 years old. So think back 10 years, 21. God knows I did stupid shit when I was 21. It could have been very easily, you know, he had a dipper where he didn't know it was a dipper and he had this and next thing you know, he's, you know, eating the face off of some guy on a freeway.
Wow.
But yeah, so while I'm talking, I'm going to sit here and try to look for it and see if I can find the exact website for you, and I'll type it up in the comments so that everyone can see it and they go, oh, okay, so she was actually telling the truth there. So there have been a couple other high-profile cases where there have been people who have pulled their teeth out. There was a rapper, musician who had actually killed his girlfriend and was pulling out his own teeth. And if I remember correctly, the cops actually did have to shoot and kill him because he was, So.
Alrighty then.
Yeah, and so that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, I can't see the love of PCP. I can't either.
That just makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
At least in my semi-limited vocabulary. I've kind of got three things going on at once right now.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I've been letting you talk while I'm just taking care of business over here on my side. Now, let's see here. I'll go over that mnemonic again, seeing that my spell check works. It's rage, redness of the skin. I forgot what that's called. Dilation. Yeah, that's it. Dilation of the pupils, delusions of adequacy or grandeur, however you want to put it. In my case,
right.
Delusions of adequacy. Astagmatism, excitation. What was the N again?
Nystagmus.
Oh, okay. That's it. And then dryness of the skin. Eggmus. Okay. Now the thing is, when I go to code this here in a little while, it's going to be like, oh, my God.
Your computer's going to go, oh.
Yep. It is. It's going to argue and fight with me. But then again, I'm used to it.
Come on.
I'll get these put in here real quick, like. And I do say this new format that we're using for our show pages, for those of us who are on EMS blogs, which, hey, guess what? You'll find my page there. So, yes, I'm there.
Well, we're both on the good site then. How does that sound?
Oh yeah, we're on a good site. And I'm just glad that it gives me the thing that just lets me click and put the HTML in, because my gosh, typing all them LIs is going to kill me.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
I totally get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I just looked real quick, and the Alberta Health Service. AlbertaHealthServices.ca will tell you that PCP can stay in your system. You can have flashbacks months after having used it, days, weeks, or months. So, and just want to make sure this is the right one.
Okay.
Yes. And doitnow.org. I'm not really sure about the validity of this website, but I'm sorry. It's about a book called PCP, Facts About Phencyclidine. So, and it also says that, yes, to read the quote, it says that, unlike LSD flashbacks, which are psychological in origin, PCP aftershocks are physically based and involve actual drug effects. Post-high bummers brought on by drug stress or fatigue have been known to occur weeks, months, or years after last use.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're going to do one, never mind. that's giving the wrong thing. So, anywho. So, yeah, there's my little spiel. There's my little spiel on PCP. I really do hope that I have a lot more information. I'm just trying to be kind of nice and not talk too much. If anyone has any questions, comments, concerns, bitches, gripes, please come to my Facebook page. Once again, Paramedic Shell and Trauma Shear, or you can email me at medictraumashear@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please, by all means, I will make sure that I answer your question as best as I can and go in from there. So,
all righty.
Head injuries.
So, we're done with.
Or do you have any housekeeping things?
Okay. Let me check my timer real quick. I hate laptops sometimes. Actually, yes, I do have a couple little things that I need to go over. Because I'm coming up on a hard break here in about 10 seconds, so I'll just go ahead and knock them out real quick. If you guys happen to have a dollar to kill and need a good book to read, I will say that The Cavalry is Coming, written by our very own John Broyles. Oh, wait a minute, that'd be me. Is available on Amazon for you Kindle users. Just do a search for it. You'll find it has a nice little ambulance on the front cover and It's all nice and pretty. It's only a dollar, so it's a cheap read. And secondly, and on the show notes page for tonight's show, along with what Xiao was saying about the effects of PCP and head injuries and all the blah, blah, blah from me being gone for so long, I will have a link on there. That link, should you decide to click on it, which I kindly, kindly, kindly pray that y'all do, will take you to a certain page that helps out, because it's that time of year again. It's Boy Scout popcorn time. So, yes, please, the link will be on the show page. So please click on it and order a lot. My son wants to sell $500 worth. But come on, we can get him more than that. And it all goes to the Scouts. Percent of the proceeds from Trails and Popcorn goes right back into local scouting, to where the Scouts can go to camp. They can have their fun activities. A lot of the underprivileged, they can actually be able to get uniforms. The Scout Reach folks, which is a great thing. I love seeing a scout in uniform. So that link will be up on the show's page as soon as I get done typing it in, and that takes care of all my housekeeping for right now. Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here. I see you love the man in uniform.
Well,
why the hell do you think he's a paramedic?
Oh, so much I could say. So much I could say.
I am.
But, you know, not everybody knows that the chat room does have a couple nice little things. So, you know, I can just type a couple things in, and nobody else in the chat room will see it.
Oh, that's nice.
So now on to head injuries.
Head injuries were the win. Ugh. And hopefully I will breeze through this enough, because I picked up a third subject that I thought was kind of interesting. And since there's very little research on it, I can kind of do it real quick. So head injuries.
There we go.
There are multiple different types of head injuries. You know, we can go from the ones where, you know, you unfortunately, you know, you slip and fall and now you cause a subarachnoid head bleed, all the way up to you're doing something stupid and you win a Darwin Award and that's how you manage to get your brains all over the kitchen table. So one of the most famous or infamous, depending on how you want to look at it, head injuries was actually, I'm sure every good little paramedic, doctor, nurse, EMT out there knows the name of Phineas Gage. Phineas Gage was the guy who had a tamping rod that was approximately, I wasn't on the right page. Okay. I had everything set up for this. he had a tamping iron that was 3 feet and 7 inches long and 1 1/4 inches in diameter, was driven through his brain. Through his head case, the skull case.
Wait, it went through his brain bucket.
Yes, it did. It went absolutely 100%. It started on the left side of his face, underneath his jaw, and behind the left eye and out the top of his head, like completely through and through. So
wow. It
was, yes. And it went fast enough, and it was so powerful, because he was tamping down gunpowder, because they were using blasting powder to blast a hole inside of a mountain. And so it was like a javelin. And so when what actually caused him to survive was the pointy end went in first. So, ladies and gentlemen, pointy end goes first. So when it entered, it went through and through, and it weighed 13 pounds, and it was still found 80 feet away. So it went through his brain bucket and landed 80 feet away. So obviously he was knocked unconscious by this, but shock and freaking surprise, he got up and he was able to walk and talk. And in our parlance, he was A&O times 4 and life was great. So
what?
Yes, yes, yes. The physician that treated him, a Dr. Edward H. Williams, he was the first person to treat him. He found Gage sitting on a chair. And in my notes, I'm going to quote directly from Wikipedia because it actually is an amazing thing. So here's the quote. About 30 minutes after the accident, Dr. Edward H. Williams, finding Gage sitting on a chair outside of a hotel, was greeted with one of the quote-unquote greatest understatements of medical history. When I, Dr. Edward H. Williams, drove up, he said, "Doctor, here's business enough for you. I first noticed the wound on the head before I alighted my carriage, the pulsations of the brain being very distinct. The top of the head appeared somewhat like an inverted funnel, as if some wedge-shaped body had passed from below upwards. During the time I was examining this wound, I was relating the manner in which he was injured to the bystanders. I did not believe his statement at the time, but thought he was deceived. Mr. Gage persisted in saying that the bar went through his head. Mr. Gage got up and vomited, and the efforts of which vomiting pressed out about a half a teacup full of brain, which fell on the floor." That is the biggest understatement in medical history. Imagine writing that crap on your trip sheet.
Oh, God. Patient squeezed out a tablespoon of gray matter.
Right, right. Now, how many of us would have medical command going, "No, you didn't"? So Phineas Gage, even though he had this big, gigantic steel rod go through his brain case and vomited out a big hunk of brain juice, he was actually not too worse for wear initially. And that was the big thing. It was initially he wasn't too worse for wear. Through my research, it said that he was pretty much A&O times four the entire time, and then he did begin to deteriorate. I mean, it did take out a good portion of his frontal lobe, which we all know is in control of your emotions. So he did start having emotional problems. He did have, he was also subject to epilepsy. Excuse me. He did actually, considering that this incident happened in the late 1800s, it was actually quite shocking to discover that they were doing, they did multiple brain, so they did the first brain surgery to kind of clean everything out, and then they did a second one because he had actually had an infection. So they went back in, you know, they did brain surgery. Imagine doing brain surgery in like 1890. And they went back in, cleaned everything out, and he was fine. But then, as I said, he in 1849, he had lost the vision of his eye. He still had a huge scar from the abscess, and he was also starting to experience seizures and also just not acting right. So this, Phineas Gage, is one of the biggest cases that anyone reads about when they're looking at head injuries, because it was such a dramatic injury at a time where, I mean, even now in 2015, I'm sure if we had someone who had a rod shoved through their skull, the likelihood of them surviving would be slim to none, even with the medical advances of 2015. Now imagine 1849. You know, they're still using leeches. they were still using leeches and swirling crap around and swirling tea around in a cup to see if this worked.
Oh my God!
Right. So by 1860, Phineas Gage was having multiple seizures a day. His emotions had deteriorated to the point where he was unstable, and that was pretty much it. He had a seizure, and we all know what happens with a seizure sometimes. And that was it. One of their treatments, which I did find this to be kind of funny. So they do all this amazing brain surgery on him, but when he died, the day he died, he had a seizure. So this was May 18th, 1860. He had a major seizure, and then at 5 o'clock in the morning on the 21st, he had another one. And what they did when the family physician came in was they bled him, thinking that'll fix the seizures.
They bled.
Yes, that was their treatment for seizures. Yes. Huh?
A little bloodletting. Oh, yeah,
a little bloodletting. That'll fix it.
But he
became status epilepticus, and that's what finally ended his life. So that is, as I said, that's the big thing. That's the one that everyone learns about when it comes to brain injuries is the Phineas Gage case, because it is so dramatic. It is so shocking. It is so, how did this work? How did someone in 1849 manage to survive having a tamping rod shoved through his brain? And actually, just to kind of put this one out here, because I believe that people might find this funny, I'm giving is it posted on my Facebook page? I'm giving a lecture on head injuries in February. And So, my very first real lecture at a conference in front of people, kind of nervous, but I'm presenting this case, and I actually went out and bought a tamping rod. So I have a tamping rod that's actually in the back seat of my car right now that is the size, shape, diameter, and weight of the tamping rod that went through his skull. So there's a pumpkin with Phineas Gage's name written all over it, and I might YouTube that one of just giving a presentation of the case and then slamming a pumpkin down on a tamping rod. Sounds kind of fun.
Yes, it does sound fun. Remind me not to piss you off.
Well, babe, I'm a second degree black belt and I can shoot. I mean, that's you're poking a bear at that point in time. So, the next one, I don't want to take up too much of your time. So the next one is...
Oh, sweetheart, the next 17 minutes are yours. I mean, it's...
Thank you. So the next one, when I was looking at head injuries, I was looking for the most obscure ones. I didn't want the ones that everyone read about. I mean, other than the Phineas Gage one, I did a report on him when I was 10. I've always been fascinated by that case. So that was really the reason why I presented that one. But when I looked, I was looking for the most unique head injuries, and that's when I stumbled onto Tophies. Tango Oscar Papa Hotel India Sierra, which means transoccipital penetrating head injuries.
Really?
Yes. In layman's terms, that means something going through the eye and into the skull.
Oh,
so those are
yummy.
Yes. And so those are the, of course, I had to research the one thing that was the rarest of them all, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all. So the very first one, and I actually posted a picture of this on my Facebook page last night. So if anyone is reading and looking at the same thing, you can go to my Facebook page and you can see a CT scan picture that I put up. And the CT scan picture that I put up is the only known suicide on record from a low-velocity penetrating object. Yeah, I know.
Okay.
I had to get morbid. Yeah, I got a little morbid here. Okay. So, 25-year-old male, schizophrenic male, managed to shove a 14.5-centimeter-long ballpoint pen through his eye socket, all the way to his cerebellum.
Ow.
That's some skill. I kind of got stuck on stupid when I read this. I was actually at work when I read this, and I took it to one of the physicians that I'm very good friends with, and we kind of looked at it, and we went, wow. That's wow. So kind of the story behind this gentleman was he was actually in a hospital. They found him lying in a pool of blood, and the guy told the patient told the physicians that he had torn out his eyeball because it tickled. So he unfortunately, you know, immediately lapsed into a coma because that's what one is wont to do whenever you shove a pen that far in your head. And they did a CT scan, but they didn't see anything. All they saw was this cavitation. And if you look at the picture, the cavitation goes from the right of the right side of the left eyeball all the way back to the cerebellum, all the way back into like touching the back of his skull. But it looks like a cavitation, like the path of a bullet. So unfortunately, he passed away because they were of the mindset that it was a bullet, because in his medical history that he had tried to attempt suicide several years earlier by shooting himself with an airsoft rifle. So unfortunately, he did pass away. And when they did the autopsy and they opened up his skull, they found the pen.
Damn.
So if you look, right. And if you look at the picture, you'll see the pen. And the end of the pen is sitting behind the left orbit. It's sitting behind the left eyeball. And so there's about a good inch and a half to 2 inches of space where he continued to use another object to push the pen all the way back in there. So, that one just, you know, that one kind of caught me as being interesting because I'm sitting here and I have a couple of pens in front of me and all I can think of is, no.
I can think of better. I think of better things to use a pen for.
I mean, I can. Yeah. So there was that one. That one's kind of my shock factor one. I am trying to be slightly delicate about it, considering I am a supporter of the Code Green campaign. So I am, I'm being delicate about it. I'm trying to talk about it as, you know, as professional as possible while also kind of bringing a little bit of levity and light to it. But, just knowing this is a suicide, just going to put that out there. Any first responder, anyone who is listening to this podcast right now, if you ever have a problem, if you are ever feeling some kind of way, my Twitter, my Facebook, my email are always open. Please, by all means, you can reach out to me at any time. I am always on my phone. I'm always on my Twitter. I'm always on my Facebook page. If you just need someone to talk to, you need someone to vent to, I've been there. I've had those calls. I've had those feelings. I've had those emotions. Please, by all means, reach out to me, and we will go from there. So, but that's my little spiel for right now. So. Moving on. So the other one that I wanted to bring up is I had two different ones that I wasn't sure which one I was going to bring up, but I think I'm going to go ahead with Tracy Morgan. So we all know that he was in a very severe car accident. He was unrestrained. This is why I always tell everyone, please buckle up. If you are, I'm a stickler about people buckling up because windshields can make ribbons out of people. And so tell everyone, I'll just find a newer, cuter model if you go through the windshield. So, and I don't move my car until you buckle up. And if you don't want to buckle up, get the hell out of my car. So, so the whole thing with Tracy Morgan, he was an unrestrained driver. He was an unrestrained passenger in a limo. He suffered severe head injuries. The media kind of vilified a little bit the fire and EMS crews who were on scene of that accident, and because of how long it took them to get them out of the limo. But I just want to say to the crews that were on scene of that, you guys did a hell of a job. it is not easy trying to cut a limousine and a tanker and a tractor trailer apart. So whatever the media says, you know what, they don't understand what we have to do. You guys did the best that you possibly could. So,
yes, they did.
Yes. So, you know, Tracy Morgan suffered a TBI or a traumatic brain injury, and due to the high velocity, because he basically was bounced around inside of a limousine, he did have severe, and you can see that now where he still has the neural deficits. So, one of the funny things that I was reading about in this article, I'll read you the quote, and I want you to see if you can figure out what's wrong with it. Upon emergency assessment, along with brain imaging like MRIs and CT scans, the Glasgow Coma Scale from 1 to 15, with 1 being the worst, is used to assess a person's level of consciousness, which correlates with the amount of potential brain damage. What is wrong with that subject? What is wrong with that sentence?
It does not measure a person's LOC.
Well, not only that, but what else is wrong with that statement?
Do you really want me to go through the list, Ben?
You can't score a one. You can't score a one.
No, you can't. No, you can't. The minimum you could score is a zero. It's
no,
zero.
Three.
You
get a three.
Three is below it.
Yeah, three is the lowest. Because remember, you get it's a one in each category. So you have eyes, verbal, and motor. And
yeah.
So if you have no movement, no spontaneous eye movement, no spontaneous speech, and no spontaneous movement, then you only get a one. So the lowest you can go is a three. And if you really want to get technical, you can score lower than a three, but it's documented differently. So, and I don't know how many people know this because I didn't find this out until I researched it. So if you have someone that is decapitated, technically you cannot assess. No, there's no technical about it. You cannot assess.
You can't assess them.
Right. You can't assess verbal or eye movement. Right.
It's like trying to give them CPR. You got one person 50 feet away from the head compressing the chest. You know, you're watching from 50 feet away. It looks like about 15, blow.
Right. Just follow the bubbles, baby. So, you know, but the way you document that particular thing is you document it as a one, but then you document patient had no head, so cannot assess eye or verbal. So, I mean, yeah, you can technically score a one or a zero, but as long as all the body parts are in the right order, you can only go down to a three. And so I did find that to be kind of funny because it was like, you know, I did actually have an EMT who emailed me about this article, and that's why I researched it. And they said to me, you know, how can a person get a one? And I said, well, you can't. Like, you can only get the lowest you can go is a three. Highest you can get is a 15, lowest you can go is a three. And then I did a little bit more research into it, and I corrected myself saying, well, yeah, you can get lower than a three, but there's a reason. Like, there's an actual documented reasoning behind why you're going to get less than a three. So, So a lot of things they talk about with, what'd you say?
I said, sorry about that. I had to dash for a real quick sec. I had to hit the mute button on my end, and I'm back.
Okay. But, yes, I mean, that's really it. I mean, about the head injuries, toe fees, as I was talking about, those are the rarest of them all, usually because of the, from my research, that's all I'm just going to continue to put that out there, from my research, toe fees are the hardest ones to live from because the path that is traveled by the penetrating object to go from the eye through the skull, it does go through a lot of the really important things. So those ones are really hardest to survive. They're also the rarest because it is kind of an unusual spot to get something stuck. But I do have, if anyone wants to ask, talk, learn whatever, please by the means go ahead and contact me. I have about 200 pages worth of research on head injuries, toe fees, raised intracranial pressure, I'm still on the whole, I don't know what the hell a mayor wave is, but I've had a lot of very, very wonderful medics who have been trying to lead me in the right direction. So hopefully the next time you are gracious enough to allow me on your podcast, I'll be able to talk about mayor waves. So how much time do we have left, Bib?
Oh, let me take a look here. Oh, we still have 4.5 minutes to kill.
Perfect timing. Perfect timing. So I said I was going to talk about just PCP and head injuries, but I really wanted to kind of get to it so that had this little special secret one kind of saved up. One of the things I want to talk about that I found just kind of researching medical stuff, remember, research, learn. This is always an evolving job. Something called double sequential defibrillation.
Double sequential defibrillation.
Oh, yeah. So this is done, this is a procedure that is done after 5 minutes of refractory V-fib. How do you do this, you might ask? You hook the patient up to two different defibrillators at the same time. So you just kind of stick four stickies on them in the right order. I mean, they're literally, you know, one next to the other in the proper positioning. And you... I'm clear, you're clear, everyone's clear, and you hit the button at the same time. So you are delivering, depending on if you have monophasic or biphasic, you're delivering between 400 to 720 joules of bite me at the same time. I know. So So this was actually discussed at an EMS Eagles in an EMS Eagles event in 2011. This did start in Wake County. Wake County was the first person were the first EMS providers to start this double sequential defibrillation. And within, as I said, this is something that happens after 5 solid minutes of refractory V-fib that is not being fixed by normal defibrillation methods. And what they discovered was, A, it worked. Why it works, there's not been much research on it, but the little bit of research that I have found, it says, this is reading from the U.S. National Library of Medicine. It said from 2008 to 2010, a total of 10 patients were treated with DSED. The median age was 76 with median resuscitation time of 51 minutes. Median number of single shocks, were 6 with a median of 2 DSED shocks delivered. V-fib broke after DSED in 7 out of 10 patients. Three of those patients had ROSC in the field, but none survived to discharge. But that was only, you know, that's looking at just this study. If I go back to the article on EMS World written by John Eric on October 10th, 2011, he says in his article that medical director Juliet Sasse told of achieving several instances of ROS, and they even had a neurologically intact survivor to hospital discharge. So,
wow.
Right. So this is kind of that new little thing that, you know, I really didn't, it's kind of back there in the little, let's talk about EMS stuff, let's talk about the cool stuff that we're doing, and there you go. So just wanted to kind of put that one out there as, you know, next thing you know, this might be along with the zombie protocol. You never know. You might be slapping on two sets of defibrillator pads and shocking the hell out of people.
Wow. I mean, yeah, just let everybody who's listening right now, if the live stream cuts off here within the next few minutes, it will still be recording for the simple fact we're going into overtime.
Woo!
Oh,
overtime!
Man. Hey, that's the best time to work a code, overtime.
Yes! Oh, my God, that was always my favorite. I loved getting a code at 6:55 in the morning because that was guaranteed at least 3 hours of overtime. Thank the baby Jesus.
Yeah,
I never understood people like... Oh, I'm sorry, go on.
I was about to say, we're going to lose some of our live listeners here because the Blog Talk Radio people say, you know, will give me the flying fickle finger of hate. But
right.
It's still recording, so, you know, get it on iTunes, listen to it tomorrow morning after everything's all caught up and posted, and you'll catch a little bit of overtime that we have.
All right, just to sign off before they make everyone disappear, I just want to thank you guys for listening. Once again, I am Paramedic Shaolin Trauma Shears. You can find me at lookingthroughaparapinkhandletraumashears.com. You can also find me as Paramedic Shaolin Trauma Shear on Facebook and at Medic Trauma Shear on Twitter. Hit me up. Thank you, guys. Have fun and be safe.
All right. Well, now the ball's in your court, hon. If you want to keep on going about the 720 joules of, oh, shit, being delivered into somebody, or if we want to go ahead and have the celebratory beer and call tonight.
You know what? I mean, when it comes to double sequential defibrillation, there's really, unfortunately, there's not a lot of information about it. It's very, I don't want to say it's new because obviously they've been doing it for almost 8 years now, but there's just not a lot of, research about it. Like, I will say that, let me pull this up because as I put the picture out there on Facebook where I showed the 90,000 things that I did, the blog, Life in the Fast Lane, that I absolutely love reading, one of the ones I read all the time, actually did post something about double sequential defibrillation. So, in their article, it is saying that Wake County was the first person Wake County was the first person to actually do this. They use two biphasic defibrillators. So, you know, the peak you can get on a biphasic is 200. And unfortunately, monophasic 360, biphasic 200. But unfortunately, there's just not enough. They just didn't do it on enough people because it's only for refractory VFib, 5 solid minutes of refractory VFib that it's not changed through normal defibrillation. So there's not, I mean, that's such a narrow subset of people that it's, you know, so you can only get so many of them. And I'm sorry, I did want to correct what I said about placing the pads. When you place the pads, you're going to do one in the traditional sternum apex configuration, and the other is going to be in the anterior-posterior configuration. I apologize about that. I had it written down both ways with a question mark next to it, and so I just wanted to double-check, put that out there so I wasn't teaching anyone wrong. But, yeah, you have your standard, and then you have the anterior-posterior configuration.
You basically have to have them on their side.
Yeah, I do have a picture of it. I will post it on my Facebook page tonight. Whenever you and I are done having our celebratory beer and kind of BSing along, I will post it on my Facebook page. The picture of a diagram of how the defibrillator pads are supposed to go. But yeah, it's actually kind of bizarre because you have these, you know, imagine, you know, your normal pads and then your not normal pads. And then the one that someone brought up to me, because I did spend 5 years in very rural medicine, there are places that are still using hands-on defibrillators. So
hands-on, that means the paddles, right?
Right.
Ooh.
I I do know of two different services right now that are, but these are extremely, extremely rural services that are still using hands-on. You know, once again, here I go again, standing up on my soapbox. I had too much wine tonight. But here I go, standing up on my soapbox again. People, if they're asking for taxes or anything like that to be raised so that it can benefit your EMS community or just public safety community, please don't vote no. We need it. I was actually very lucky to be involved in a system when I lived in BF Egypt that was funded by the taxpayers. It was a completely volunteer system, but it was funded by the taxpayers. And it was amazing. New and up-to-date equipment. No one paid for an ambulance ride. It was absolutely amazing. And then I come to a place where it's not, and people fight when we say, hey, you know, our ambulance is 25 years old. I have ridden in a wood-paneled ambulance. So, I'm sorry, that's my little soapbox. But Wake County has been doing this, and New Orleans EMS, which has their really cool show, Night Watch, they're both using this, and both Wake County and NOLA EMS have both said that they've had people that have survived neurologically intact to discharge or with some minor neural deficits. So it seems as if, just from the research that I've done, as I said, there's very, very little research on this. It seems like greater than 50% of patients who have refractory VFib who are given this double sequential defibrillation do convert to a functioning rhythm and do walk out of the hospital with neurologically intact. So here's hoping that in the next couple of years we'll be teaching double sequential defibrillation. I don't get me wrong, I kind of like to do that. I'm too young. I missed out on intracardiac epi, so I'd like to kind of do something kind of cool.
The big needle, you're saying? Only done in hospitals now?
I missed out on it. I feel like I missed something. I feel like I was actually talking to Hawkeye, one of my very good, he's been my partner for, oh my God, we met in medic class. So he's been my partner for the last 8-9 years. We've been best friends. Oh my God, it's nuts. We've been through thick and thin together. We've known each other for 10 years and he's just amazing. But we were actually talking last night about all of the little things that we didn't get to do that the baby EMTs that we're seeing don't get to do. And so I feel like I'm like totally away talking over your time, but I was in hospital. I work as a paramedic in hospital, and someone came in with a busted femur and they whipped it and they needed a hair traction splint, and I whipped it out and I went, I know how to use it. And the ambulance that we stole it off of had two baby providers. There was like a baby EMT and a little baby medic, and they had never used one before. And I went, so oh, my God, I'm old.
I know how to use it, but I've never used one either. I've been doing this a couple of years.
I have used, as I said, this is year 13. I just passed 13 in August. And I talk about my certain paramedic on Facebook. He was the very first person I ever used with a hair traction splint with, and he kind of walked me through it. And then I used one when I lived in Small City, USA, and I used one a couple of times when I lived here. So it's not – I haven't used it a lot. I certainly have not used it a lot to be proficient in it, but I've used it enough that it's – you know, I don't look at it like a medieval torture device and go, what the hell is this shit? Like the nurses in my hospital did. They all looked at me like, how do you use this? And I went, I stepped up, dun-da-da, super medic, I got it. 1 point for paramedics. It was amazing. It was there were two medics on at the time, and the two of us, we just went ahead and we went to town on this poor kid, and we got him, we made him naked because the patient's not yours until they're naked and yours. And we got the hair traction splint, and we got him all set up, and the poor little nurse was looking at me like, the one nurse looked at me and she goes, "Can you show me how to do that later? Because I've never done that before." Yeah, I know you don't know how to do
it. Well, nurses don't really need to use them.
I will say working in hospital, oh my God, we're still going into overtime, but this is kind of fun. I will say working in hospital has given me a whole new appreciation and hatred for nurses. Well, here's the thing. I get their
point. I can relate to this because I was in a hospital unit before I retired. So, yeah, I've had to deal with nurses as a combat medic.
Right.
And I'm just looking at them like, seriously, get out of the way. Let a real medic do things. I mean, they're going over there. We don't do that in our ER. I know. I do it on the street. Of course, I was a basic on the rescue squad, but.
Right. You're like, oh, I did this in my sleep like a year ago. But no, actually, my job in the emergency room is I do kind of a bastardized form of triage. When a patient walks in, I get them registered and take their vitals and figure out if they're going to die right then or if they can wait a few minutes. And my other job is, and that's why I'm sitting up front. And if I'm sitting in back, I do IVs and just basic patient care. But what's really interesting is my job title. I'm not a paramedic in my hospital. I'm not going to say what my job title is. No. I'm not an actual paramedic in my hospital. I'm not going to say what my job title is because it'll be very easy to identify me. But
just suffice it to say
that it's not paramedic. And so what I can do on the street, I can't do in hospital.
And vice versa.
Because when I'm on the street, I can go to the full level of national registry. Think of this national registry protocols. I can do everything the national registry says I can do. In hospital, all I'm allowed to do is do IVs and give oxygen. I have to call a nurse.
Needles.
Right. Exactly. Perfect.
No, not even basic. That's first responder with needles.
Right. So I'm the one that they call when they have the little old lady who has absolutely no IV access, and I'm the one who manages to sink the 18 in the back of the bicep because I'm, I am paragod. And so,
think Kelly has a trademark on that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Kelly does have the trademark on Paragon. I'm super meth. There we go. Or does he have a trademark on that one, too?
No, I don't think he has super meth. I think he's some dude.
Fine. So he is Paragon. I love him dearly. I love him dearly. But he is Paragon. I'm super medic. So, yes, I am the super medic who gets the IVs in places that people didn't know existed. But that's all I can do in hospital. I can't give medications. I can't give my state-allowed medication. I can't even hook up a freaking bag or disconnect. If I'm taking a patient down to scan, I can't even disconnect the bag of saline. I have to call a nurse to do it. And what usually happens is I walk out, I look at the nurse and say, "Hey, 15 needs their bag disconnected." And they look at me and say, "Okay, go ahead and do it," and they document that they did it. But that's my job in